I'm very excited to have a brand new guest on Church and Culture today. His name is Dr. Anthony Rizzi. Dr. Rizzi is the director of the Institute of Advanced Physics. He is a world-renowned scientist and Thomistic philosopher. He has degrees in physics from MIT and Princeton, including a PhD from Princeton. He has gained worldwide recognition in theoretical physics by solving an 80-year-old problem in Einstein's theory of relativity. He has been a senior scientist of the Caltech's Laser Interferometer Gravitational Wave Observatory, a project that won the Nobel Prize in Physics in 2017. He has worked on the manned Mars craft and on the Mars Observer spacecraft and received the NASA Award, as well as a Martin Marietta New Technology Award. He is the author of many books and articles across multiple fields. I'll be telling you about his website for the Institute for Advanced Physics a little later. In addition to his many appearances on TV, radio, and the Internet, he has been a regular on EWTN for the past 19 years. One of his best books, I believe, is entitled Science Before Science, A Guide to Thinking in the 21st Century. Dr. Anthony Rizzi, welcome to Church and Culture.
Well, thank you. It's good to be here, Dale.
Well, I'm really very overwhelmed by all you have done and by the work of the Institute for Advanced Physics. I want our people to know about it. The website is www.iapweb.org. That's iapweb.org. And I'm fascinated by the fact that you're, you know, a very devout Catholic, obviously, very ardent Thomist, and you are basically calling into question the direction of physics, not so much after Newton's revolution, but after the physics became a mathematical imperiological study. In other words, as you put it to me on the phone when we talked, physics has become a matter of ideas in the brain, mathematical ideas, rather than about the grasping of physical reality, which is what physics is supposed to be. Now, am I right in my summary of that? And secondly, why is that important?
So I would correct it a little bit. I would say it starts with Galileo. It basically starts with the scientific revolution, is because physicists have sort of been checked out of the larger conversation, what we might call the humanities conversation. Most humanities people aren't aware of what physics does. Having to listen to humanities people like Francis Bacon tell you what it is, and they basically have no idea what it is. And what happened at the scientific revolution, therefore, most people don't know. They usually, you know, talk about, well, you know, we have the method of, hypothesis, test hypothesis, reform hypothesis, you know, which is really, if you think about it, it's kind of stupid, right? Because anybody, any child knows, you know, they say he falls off a swing and he hurts his ankle. He says, well, that theory didn't work too well. I'm not going to do that again. So the scientific method can't be something that easy, because for the one thing, it wouldn't have the power it has. For the other thing, it would make everybody beforehand stupid. And obviously, they weren't stupid. And
Well, you say repeatedly something that as a Thomist, I agree is so important, that all knowledge begins with the senses.
Yes. And
there is no knowledge implanted in the human brain that somehow we turn inwardly and discover. It's all through the senses.
That's right. Everything starts with what we know through the senses, and you know, that's the, you know, sort of baseline thing that we're not, you know, oftentimes, like I had a priest ask recently, you know, so we're born, we're conceived with the knowledge of the natural law, right? And I'm like, no, we're conceived with nothing in our mind. We have nothing. It's what Thomas says, and Locke quotes him, tabula rosa, you know, we have nothing. There's nothing on our mind. There's no morality. There's nothing. We have to figure everything out through what we get through the senses. And basically, for all practical purposes, nobody knows that anymore, not in any kind of habitual way, which is how we men know, is not by just, you know, picking up Aristotle and quoting him. It's by living and how we think. And the whole point is the scientific revolution changed the way we do physics, and therefore it changed the way we understand what we get through the senses, and therefore it changed everything about the way we think, and therefore we're a mess. We think we can talk about metaphysics when we don't know physics, and we don't therefore know even what the scientific method is, because we need to know physics and then the metaphysics that follows from it before we can ask ourselves what is our science. And to get back to the kind of the question you asked, so what happened at the scientific revolution was the modern scientific method, but you have to define that. And the modern scientific method is, what is that? It's what I call equation-first physics. So he didn't use equations. He was still doing the mindset of creating a logical system of symbols whereby you capture nature in a logical system of symbols, and it gradually, got you know, very codified into an equation.
But what you're saying is there's nothing wrong with scientists using symbols and equations if it's based upon observable reality, right?
No, I'm actually saying that there's nothing wrong with it is correct. That part I totally agree with. What I'm saying is what's wrong is to act as if you're finished when you have a symbolic system and say that's what it means to know, is to have a symbolic system in which I can make predictions. Because modern scientists know better than anybody else. You have to go by data. But the problem is that we have to stop and see what it is, this codification. The organizational principles aren't the thing. And that's the way most moderns think, is the organizational principles equals the thing. How I organize it in my mind is the thing. And the thing is not my organization of it. My organization of it should just be a convenience, an aid, an instrument by which I see into reality.
Well, let me ask you this then. Einstein's formula of E equals MC squared, how then should we regard that in terms of what you're saying right now?
So, I mean, E equals MC squared is a way of talking about energy, mass, and the speed of light. That is basically an outgrowth of the theory that Einstein came up with called special relativity. So we should regard that as a statement about the nature of motion and the cause of motion, which I cover in the Kids Introduction to Physics that I recommend people get, where you can actually see what Newton did, because what Newton did is the first time the problem is really codified, because Newton completely equationalizes everything so that the questions about what is motion and all that are left aside in terms of, and then replaced with an organizational structure. Now, Newton really didn't want to do that. He said at the beginning, I'm not going to ask about these kind of things. I'm just going to give you the system. And so that's what he does. But he himself never answers what it is that he did, and nobody else after him ever does it. And the Institute for Advanced Physics is, for the first time, people that have actually said, okay, we got this nice organizational system, starting with Galileo, but really codified with Newton, and then just got more and more deeply equation alone as time went on. And we've said what it means. And so you have to understand what's called mechanics, what's called the Newtonian understanding of motion first, before you get to special relativity, which is now more specialized, which tells you more about nature and the nature of the powers that cause locomotion. And those things are just glossed over. So if you ask the average person, you know, what causes motion, they don't know. You ask the physicist, he doesn't know. the what is of nature is gone in people's minds. They don't ask what is, they create metaphors and analogies. And
Anthony, let me ask you this.
Yeah.
Before Newton, how did the medievals regard the cause of motion?
So before Newton, so what people don't realize is that, if you don't mind, I'll just go back and do a little history. Would that be good?
Oh, please do.
So but what basically happens is you have the pre-Socratics kind of trying to figure this stuff out. And you have Plato comes along and he kind of half figures things out. But he doesn't, it takes his student, Aristotle, to really figure it out for the first time generically. And, you know, Plato, to show, everyone knows Plato was a genius, but people don't really know how much, really to see how much of a genius Aristotle is, maybe the best way is to look at what Plato said about him. One time Plato was absent, and he said, the nous is absent, which means the intellect is absent. He was there, but Aristotle wasn't there, so the intellect was absent.
So what is it that Aristotle figured out?
So Aristotle figured out first in physics, how locomotion works, what things are very generically, that there are things that have their own existence, and that properties that come out of that existence that reveal the substance through our senses. He figured out, you know, then from that he figured out that God had to exist, and he figured out that human nature has an immaterial core part that can't die. He figured out basically the whole preamble of the faith.
Well, he figured out a physics that could lead to what we as Thomists think of as a realist metaphysics.
Yes, but I wouldn't say it that way, because that's the scientized way. I would push back and say that's the scientized way of saying it. That's the subjective way of saying
Fair
it.
Fair enough.
I would say it doesn't matter what I think, what you think, what Aristotle thinks. It matters what reality is. And Aristotle, for the first time, saw reality. He didn't come up with a system that we can call by a certain name. He saw reality for the first time as it really was, in a scientific fashion instead of a confused infra-scientific fashion. He saw it clearly at a generic level. He was missing the specifications.
He had enough
generic physics to come up with a generic metaphysics that include proving the existence of God and the immortality of the human soul.
So whereas Heraclitus and Parmenides resorted to poetry, essentially, and images to describe their understanding of motion change in the world,
mm-hmm.
Aristotle applied reason, and instead of imagination, so to speak. Now, my question to you is, how did Newton change or challenge the way Aristotle saw physics?
So, do you want to answer that first, or can I go back to the history and then get to that and historically?
No, I want you to go to Newton first.
Okay, so I'll go to Newton. So, let's see, I can't really go to Newton without going to the Middle Ages.
Well, go to the Middle Ages is fine. We love the Middle Ages on this show.
Okay,
go ahead.
So I'll do an abbreviated history then. So what happens after Aristotle is that the Greek, what Father Stanley Yaki calls the first death of the conception of physics happens, of science, I'm sorry, science happens because the Greek culture is not able to maintain the great genius of Aristotle, and culturally it dies. And it doesn't reappear again until Catholic culture makes a culture of its own in which the intellect is respected, the primacy of the senses is respected, and then you get the great scientists of the Middle Ages, the first of which is St. Thomas Aquinas, who discovers that Aristotle's already figured it out and builds on it. And from that great planting of St. Thomas comes the great scientists of And the general Catholic milieu comes the great scientists of the Middle Ages, which includes people like John Buridan. And John Buridan figured out that impetus causes motion. He didn't quite understand it. He confusedly realized, and he had some really good arguments.
Wait a minute. What causes motion?
Impetus. It's a quality of a body that moves the body. He didn't understand the way Newton was able to figure it out. But he realized that force is not what causes motion. But he was confused. He's the first one to really say this. And it kind of gets lost. It gets passed along to Galileo. Galileo sees this, and Galileo starts the process whereby you make this system to incorporate stuff, and that allows you to get a lot of specificity about nature that you couldn't get without this method. So this method allows you to take all this detailed data and put it into a system, and Newton then follows up on that and comes up with a system, which is basically his two equations.
In Buridan, it was impetus that caused motion, not force.
Right. Yes.
And then you went to Galileo and said something about he used this method. Are you talking about the scientific method now?
The modern scientific method, which does...
Now, so that means there's a fundamental break between Buridan and Galileo?
There's a fundamental break because Galileo was the first one to really take the method that was sort of brewing for the last 100 years and use it effectively, which is to gather information and sort of prescind from, while you're gathering it, sort of prescind from asking what is questions. And
Hold on. This is really important. Just a second.
Yes.
Are you talking about the 100 years prior to Plato, Galileo? Are you talking about Copernicus? Who are you talking about?
Let's see. I'm talking about that there's the time between Buridan and, which is the Middle Ages, into Galileo is 100, 200 years, whatever it is. And there's lots of people in between there, the Oxford calculators and all kinds of other people. But in that period, there was a development of thinking which was trying to sort of inchoately, like everything gets formed first, figure out a way of encapsulating knowledge in a system of thought.
And okay, hold on there. Because what you said was really, really gotten. You said they stopped asking the what is question, right?
Yes.
And I think that will communicate with our audience when we say what is. In other words, what is the reality of the situation? What is being, you know, and...
Yes, what is that in front of my face? What
right.
Is that thing?
And so...
Stop asking that question, because the reason, though, there was a reason, there was a positive reason, and that is to try and... Because you realize at some point you have to move beyond Aristotle, and you have to, the very generic things you know are not what nature is. Nature is particular. There's Deal Hudson and there's, you know, Anthony Rizzi. There's not man. And so you finally have to start getting more and more specification, and there's a confused realization coming out of the deep intelligence of the and thought of the Catholic culture that you have to find a way to get to the specific. And they start coming up with, you know, it's really Descartes, the first one.
Well, hold on, Anthony, I'm going to slow you down, because
yeah.
I think it's really important to understand this.
Yeah, I'm glad, yeah.
And I mean, you got all the information, so you're going to have to rely on me to pace you
yeah,
a little bit, okay?
Yeah, let's do it.
There's nothing wrong with trying to be a systematic thinker. Right?
No. You need
so. But so, what was it about Galileo as a systematic thinker that went in the wrong direction?
Okay, so there you need to be systematic, because the point that I'm trying to raise is you need to get back to the particular, and the particular is, you know, it's infinite. There's all kinds of particulars, and so you need a systemic. Approach to capture all that particular. And that's what Descartes really did with math first, is he came up with this idea that you can make basically what amounts to an equation, and you can, like, get the square root of minus one, which is, what is that? What is, you know, where is the square root of minus one anything? But it's part of a system, and it captures really important aspects of reality without you having to focus on them. So it's a positive thing. It's just like any tool, it's a positive thing, but if you take the tool for the thing, you know, that's a, if you take my hammer that I'm building the house with for the house, because it built the house, then I'm really making a huge mistake. The hammer's not at fault, it's my own understanding of what I'm doing.
And that's why you call Descartes the father of idealism.
Well, yeah, that's the sense in which I call him the father of idealism, whereas other people say it because he came up with an idealistic philosophy, but I'd say it for a different reason.
You're not focusing on the cogito.
No.
You're focusing on the way in which he used mathematics, which was really, from what I understand, his greatest stroke of genius.
Yes, a stroke of genius. I'm focusing. See, we have to refocus whenever we have an evil, and the more powerful that evil is, we should look at it for the good back behind it. So whenever there's an evil that's spreading, and it's really powerful. It has to be, because evil by definition is simply a privation of a good, something a good, something a thing should have that it doesn't have. And the power, the evil, the power it has is from its good, not from its evil.
Going back to Galileo, what is the, was there a direct impact of Galileo on Descartes, or was Galileo simply a precursor, a systematizing precursor to Descartes?
So Descartes came up with this good thing of modern mathematics, but he misunderstood it, and that's why he got into the habit of just using the system and not the thing, and that's what made him write an idealist philosophy, not the other way around. Just to codify what I just said, that's why I wouldn't say he's the father of idealism because of his philosophy, but because of his bad habits.
Okay.
And his great discovery, but that set the atmosphere for the physics to do the same thing, which is to systematize so that you could capture all these things in a way that the sort of dull human mind couldn't capture, and get all the specificity, all the particulars in your head in the system that you then, which meant to happen is you look at it and say, now what do I have? Instead, the systematizing became the end, and Galileo was in that milieu, and he realized that this could really make physics change, and he did some profound things with respect to motion, with respect to the understanding of the planets, and so forth. But it wasn't really he that codified the scientific method. It was Newton. Newton was the prototypical for physics, and therefore for all the sciences, the prototypical systematizer, the prototypical equation first. That the importance of the equation came from Newton. His codification really brought and showed the power of the method to capture all kinds of particulars. He captured the particulars of motion on Earth and in motion in the sky.
Was he a direct challenge to Aristotle?
Only in the sense that it avoided the what is question. He was using, like I argue in my Science Before Science and the various other things, that you have to start with what you see. So Newton had to start. Aristotle already figured out the generic. Newton figured out the specific. But he never really answered. He very clearly says in his work, The Principia, that he hasn't answered these what is questions. But he's come up with a system to give predictions about the physical world that captures all kinds of deep information about the nature of the physical world without ever asking what it is that he's discovered.
And this is all based upon two equations of Newton?
Two equations, F equals ma and F equals gmm over r squared.
And that means?
That means the first one, I mean, this is a little lesson in freshman physics, but it basically has, the first equation has to do with how the predictions of what a force can do to a body in terms of an equation. You give an equation of a body when it has a certain force on it. The second equation has to do with the force that gravity puts on things.
What about whatever happened to Baryton's impetus?
So that it basically just gets used as a concept called inertia within his system that never gets noticed to having any reality to it. It's just part of a structure that makes predictions.
And so you of course, as a physicist, look upon Newton's achievement as one of the greatest intellectual achievements ever, right?
Yes.
So what went wrong?
So what went wrong is that to write these system down and get all these particulars organized and get them organized in such a wonderful way, but never ask what is the nature that's revealed by this equational structure that I found. What is F equals MA mean? Tell me about nature. What does it tell me about a physical thing? I know what a physical thing is. It's something that is something that can become something else. I talk about this in my kids' introduction to physics. And that's the best introduction to get this basic ideas back, is the kids' introduction to physics. And then I have physics for first communion that shows you how you go from that to the theology of the Eucharist and shows you the necessity of starting with your senses. And it'll really help you know, bring out the stuff that Newton did. But the point is that impetus is buried in this concept, this kind of half-contradictory concept of inertia. Contradictory not from the sense within the equation works fine, but the understanding of what is. So you ask the average person what is a physical thing, and they just kind of mumble, with, you know, what the heck.
Well, I think you're right about that, because they've, you know, the tradition of Aristotle and Aquinas has been shoved out of curricula, you know, since the turn of the last century.
I mean,
but you know what we're coming up to break, Anthony, and so what you're saying is that Newton did come up with these groundbreaking equations, but he understood he wasn't getting to the issue of quiddity.
Right.
Of isness, right?
Yes.
He understood that.
That's right. He understood that. That's right. Right.
Now, did he warn his followers, his students, you know, this, don't use this, don't treat this in a way that I didn't intend it to be treated?
I don't think he ever specifically warned people of that, but he said it, and then he expected it himself. He just never, you know, what happens is by habit, you know, you can get into a bad habit, and it makes you lose things you didn't plan on losing. So you get into a bad habit, you get results that you want, and you just stop thinking about what your original goal was. And so as time goes on, even though Newton didn't think this, he never really went back and figured out and clearly stated the things that Aristotle had already done. So what the effect was to basically, right now, nobody has habitual knowledge of Aristotle. They all have habitual knowledge of Newton, which is not a knowledge, it's just a way of proceeding, a practical way of proceeding through life.
So is it a kind of, is the attitude that knowledge that creates practical outcomes is all we need?
Yeah, it's the I would
utility?
It's not clarity in that way, but that's effectively what it is. When you get output, if it works, quote unquote, if it gets you an output that you can predict, that you can do stuff with, then you're done. And that's the way most people think about it. And Catholics think about it this way too. They think in terms, okay, we gotta get people in the Catholic Church, so we say stuff. If this doesn't work, we say something else. Truth is lost in that. Like, is it true? What is reality really is? It becomes, well, this guy says this. My position is realist, his position is so. Everything becomes a description of somebody else and a commentary on somebody else. You never talk about reality because, practically speaking, nobody does it, so why would you do it?
Anthony, we're going to take a short break. I'm talking to Dr. Anthony Rizzi about physics and about its importance in our general cultural decline. We'll be back in just a moment. Back with Dr. Anthony Rizzi, who is the director for the Institute of Advanced Physics. A fascinating conversation about the history of the idea of physics and its place in our knowing and its place in science in general. Before we continue that conversation, Anthony, I'd like to tell our listeners about the Institute for Advanced Physics. I went through your entire website over the past few days and read things there, and I just found it a marvelous resource in so many ways. Tell us about what you do.
Okay, so just that, the website is iapweb.org, Institute for Advanced Physics, web.org, iapweb.org. And basically what we do is we're a research and educational organization doing physics, advanced physics, as well as the basic physics in a way that starts from what you actually see and uncovering what all the great physics of the last 400 years has been telling us and answering. So we have very basic things from children's stuff, like the Kids' Introduction to Physics, which I've mentioned, and the Physics for First Communion, that stuff. And basically, you can teach it. I taught it to my 2-year-old daughter. But then we're working on quantum field theory and general relativity now, and we're publishing, you know, papers and things that pave the way for these full answer to say what is the world. So that's basically what we're doing, is giving back the foundation, but to show people that this affects the everything. We've got, you know, everything from articles on political science, like What is America article, to moral issues like the death of justice, an article on the death of justice, to theological issues on grace, what the nature of grace, and theological stuff in our magazine, Physics and a Culture magazine. And so we're trying to show, help people see that this affects culture. If you don't have the right physics, then you don't understand what is America. You don't understand grace. You don't understand very basic things. And so, kind of to summarize our mission, you know, Jesus admonishes the apostles, how can you, or I guess it's John that talks about how Jesus would admonish the apostles to say, how can you talk about the Father in heaven and love the Father in heaven, claim to love the Father in heaven you can't see, when you don't love the brother you can see? That's, and what's being used there is simply the basic idea that everything you know comes through what's seen, you know, through the senses. If you don't know the physical world, you can't know God. If you don't, you, if you're talking about the Trinity, it's really arrogant if you don't know what a physical thing is. And that's, you know, this is sort of a baseline of that principle that's being invoked there by John, to say that the invisible God depends on your visible knowledge. And if you don't get that visible knowledge, if you don't have the physics, then you're really doing a quite arrogant, un-Christian thing, which is presupposing that you know God without knowing what you see right
now. But your institute is in a fundraising mode right now, right?
Oh yes, yeah. Thank you for bringing that up. We have a matching program right now, so people, we really do, because of our work is so sort of intellectually deep, it's hard sometimes to get people aware of the primacy of it. So we have a doubling. One of our anonymous donors has said that they will, any donation that comes in now up to $15,000 will be doubled by him. So we encourage it to help our mission, that to donate now until, I think it's this Saturday where the doubling ends. So,
well, this will be the day this interview is being heard on Imperial Radio.
That's right.
And
yeah.
I hope people will, you know, go to www.iapweb.org and consider helping you guys.
Yeah, that'd be great.
Now, give us a little more history lesson after Newton.
Okay, so we got from the Middle Ages. The Middle Ages planted this this understanding of the world that's a generic understanding, and advanced beyond that, beyond what the Greeks had done, beyond what had been done before that, and to the point where we have this advent of the scientific method, which is a system where a system of symbols with logic is used to make predictions about the world, and in so doing, coming up with all kinds of interesting information about the world, very particular information. As I said, Newton did that with his Principia. And so the next thing that happens historically is you start getting, you know, this is the time in the Renaissance when the science is coming by, and what happens is reason now becomes empirometric, what Jacques Maritain called empirometric reasoning. In other words, reasoning becomes this process of making equations, making systems to make predictions. Instead of understanding, that the process of systematization becomes ordered towards itself, towards making a better system. It's a kind of, you know, really degraded thing to become your own end instead of the tool you're meant to be, but that's what happens. And so reason now becomes empirometricism, and the Enlightenment, not knowing the science itself, the humanities people in it, trying to do what they can with the physics they've been given, says, okay, that's what it must be, is it's just systematization. And that's where we get Immanuel Kant, sort of codifies the scientism in the Enlightenment. And in that point, Enlightenment becomes empirometricism. Enlightenment becomes having an equation, not real reasoning. And the trick of words that happens then makes people disreason, makes even Catholics start dissing reason, and as something overemphasized or something, as if that were the problem of the Enlightenment, when in fact the problem was reason was replaced with simply the systematized aspect.
Well, there was, philosophically, there was the growth of voluntarism during the Renaissance.
Yes.
And you know, the will's primacy over the intellect. You, of course, had the creation of political science in Machiavelli. right? Which of course
yes.
is about the about power and will.
Yes.
And you, but you do have these marvelous uses of science in the great art of, like, Leonardo da Vinci,
yes.
who
yes.
was very much a scientist in his planning and preparation for his paintings, which, unfortunately, we don't have that many of them.
No, that's right. I mean, it's a mixed bag, because you have these positives that comes from both the deep fruit of Catholic tradition built into Europe, that makes its intellectual sort of flourishing happen, but it's all contaminated increasingly by system first, by equation first thinking, and you get the major philosophies basically dissing reason. I mean, Kant is a basic, it's hard to hear it for the moderns, but Kant is a basic dissing of reason. It's basically we can't know anything. The thing itself is not knowable. And so therefore, of course the will's first, because you don't know anything, so all you have left is just to will stuff. And so what happens is systems, you know, that's where you get the first scientized forms of government, like communism. Marx is exactly right. If you define science the way we do today, which is simply equation first, then communism is the appropriate form of government. So that is that's why everything leans towards communism, because that's our physics principles that we currently have. Only they don't work with America. America is based in the natural law. It's based, my argument in What is America, that America has implanted is like no place else the Catholic tradition in terms of its preamble, strongly in its government, strongly in its thinking, strongly in its action, and that makes it, you know, totally have to be destroyed by the scientific, by our own principles. We've got to destroy
it. Let's go back to Kant. What people should know about Kant more specifically is that he said we cannot know the thing itself.
Right.
But what we know, we all human beings know in the same way, because all human beings are organizing sense data by intellectual categories, and that everyone shares those categories, and so we see the world the same way. There may be disagreements, but they can be settled. But what we know about the world is not the Ding an sich. It's not the thing in itself.
No, that's right.
So he sort of traps everybody into this kind of intersubjectivity, right?
Yes. Yeah, because he forgets that everything you know comes through what you know through the senses, because he's looking over Newton's shoulders and he's saying, how do I understand? How do I get rid of skepticism? So he goes to where the empirometricism, where the science, where the physics is, which is, okay, you just make a system. So I have to do like Newton and make a system that'll defend, quote-unquote, reason. And it's not a defense of reason. It's a destruction of reason, because reason becomes sort of a Rubik's Cube in the corner of my brain. It doesn't have anything to do with the real world, because I can't know the thing in itself. It becomes a constructing of pre-existing categories in my brain. And that's
yes.
the way most moderns think.
Now, How did this way of thinking, I would guess that Kantian reason would just encourage this reign of mathematical physics, equational physics in the place of
yes.
a physics of observation, right?
Yeah, it's observation, but it's observation ordered towards making an equation to make predictions about the world, not ordered towards understanding, ordered towards system building. And that's where Kant, I would say what you're saying is correct, but what I would say is I'd go back to what I just said, which is that the physics that we have is in system physics. So when you have a metaphysics, you're going to do like Kant, you're going to build on that system to make a metaphysics that matches the physics that you have, and you're not going to have access to the world
right.
because you're not looking through the senses. So
right.
Kant codified the physics of the day and set the modern world so it had a metaphysics that could match to its physics.
Right. Well, who then become the primary players in this narrative that we started with the pre-Socratics and Aristotle and Buridan and then Galileo and Newton and Descartes? Who become the major players after the Renaissance and the Enlightenment?
So after Kant, you're talking about?
Yeah.
So I would say that you know, what happens after Kant is, first of all, so basically you had Newton and Galileo sort of redirect the metaphysics unintentionally, not intentionally, but unintentionally, because they didn't ever come back and ask the what is question. So that left the metaphysics fixed by Kant, and then what happens next is you start developing it in other fields. It starts moving into chemistry and biology. It starts moving into, so one of the big players is Darwin, who systematizes biology in a way that makes it what Maritain would call empiriological. Now, the biology is not related enough to the core of the physical world through the property of quantity, so it can't get the equational structure as serious, and it's much weaker in its ability to even get the particulars of the world that it has to, but yet you can still do it with biology. It's sort of the last science that you can do it with, because it's so related, so deeply related to the physical aspect of quantity still, that you can make an empirological science out of it. And he did, and that's the first step of dehumanizing, making man himself a system by just categorizing it as a system of things. And most people miss this, you know, most people miss the actual core thing, and they look at some of the outputs of what's said, and so they diss the science to keep their outputs, and it becomes, you know, as I said, that each person builds a different system. And you see what happens during this time as the church starts pushing back with pretty heavy might, you know, in the Vatican I, basically defending human reason against everybody else, because human reason has been reduced to empirometricism, to equation-first thinking. And the Council Fathers don't know this, but there's still enough scientists left in the church at this point. There's none left now outside the Institute, really, to speak of. But at that point, there's still enough, and they're still, wait a second, something's wrong here, and they clearly state that you can prove the existence of God by human reason alone, which is a complete rug pull for, you know, for the scientism, because the science, that means you have to go back to nature. Actually, go back to nature. You can't just use a system. And but even so, Thomism is being wiped out at this time. You know, the story about Newman trying to find a Thomist. He couldn't find a Thomist. He was enough of a Catholic to know.
They were all in Italy.
They were all hiding in Italy.
Yeah.
But don't realize that that's why Leo XIII had to bring back Thomism, St. Thomas, because he had left.
Yeah, and he replanted it in Louvain, Belgium.
Yes.
Immediately
he became scientized, and it wasn't until the...
It did become scientist. That's right. Let me ask you this question, and I'm sure some of the listeners are thinking about this.
Sure.
Given what all we've been talking about, you have this remarkable flowering of physics at the beginning of the century around Albert Einstein, who was born in 1879.
Yes.
Who was part of an intellectual circle that included many other very highly thought of philosophers, mathematicians, and eventually quantum physicists. What, you know, take us up to there. Einstein, do you want to describe Einstein's gift in the same way you did Newton's, in that this was a breakthrough equation, a breakthrough understanding, which then became the thing in itself rather than what it was attempting to describe?
So I would say that even bigger than Darwin was Maxwell in the 1800s. Maxwell, James Clerk Maxwell, that most laymen don't know him, but he was the one that really, really took the equational structure to a new level. And it's just a wonderful thing he did, but basically around understanding light. And his equations, there's four equations, and they're just amazing equations. Every freshman learns them, and people should know more about them. But that those equations really, really bootstrap, wow, these equations can really work. We really can capture really aspects of nature, and it made people more and more complacent with the direction things were going. And
so this is an example of the way the Scottish Enlightenment created a greater and greater emphasis on mathematical equations.
Well, I wouldn't say, I mean, I think you're going the wrong direction. I think that's the tendency of the larger culture that doesn't know that physics is the first science, is to think that the larger culture creates the physics. It's the other way around. The physics creates the larger culture. What you think of the physical world creates the larger culture. So Maxwell, being part of the development of modern physics, helped to make the Scottish Enlightenment what it is, and made the Scottish Enlightenment be what it is, and gave it the power to be listened to. If it wasn't for Newton, none of this would happen. Everyone would laugh at these people, but it's because of modern science, because of the power of modern physics, that these things get implanted in the first place, and then the humanities people that promote them and bring them into the humanities realm get their the voice and why they say what they're saying to begin with.
By the way, Anthony, it's an interesting footnote that in the 60s and 70s and 80s, the French philosophers like Derrida and Foucault were brought into universities through the literature departments. So you have the same kind of thing you're describing, the humanities folks becoming the conduit for bad ideas.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that is the thing, is that the literature is the expression of the thought, and it's the most universal expression of the thought and the most human expression of the thought. And if the grounding of the thought is confused or wrong, then that comes out in the literature. It's of the nature of the thing. You know, you get the beauty you do in the Middle Ages and so forth because of the depth of, and clarity of the thought. And you get the ugliness and the confusion because of the unorderedness and the unintegratedness and the unawareness and the ungroundedness of the thought. And the Diderot and those people, you know, they're just, like you say, they're digested it and they brought it and it gets into the literature because that, you know, what we paint, what we write, is what we have in our understanding. And
now, who would you go to after James Clerk Maxwell?
So after Maxwell, I would go to Einstein. So with Einstein, you get special relativity. You get the really, for the first time, the robust inclusion of time, the ninth category of property of physical things that I discuss in my kids' introduction to physics, that now gets incorporated into an equation. And that was huge, to put time into an equation and to get rid of time, basically, to make time and like space. But meanwhile, I haven't described what's happening with math. I mean, with math, you've got people like Hilbert trying to prove of all of math from within math. And then Gödel showing that you can't do that.
Anthony, go back and say that all again, but give us a little more rich version of that.
Okay, so Hilbert, so in math, you have a parallel thing happening where you have the mathematician named Hilbert, who's a great mathematician who came up with a lot of very important things and ended up being used in physics, proposing the idea and wanting to show that mathematics could prove itself. And so he set up a program to try and do that. He's a rich program with lots of really smart people involved to try and show that math could sort of prove itself. And then the very famous mathematician Gödel came up with what he called, what we call now the Gödel's proof, that any system that's more complicated than arithmetic will contain a contradiction if you try to make it prove everything, every proposition in it. And so that proved that the whole project of trying to make math prove itself was bogus, and it made everybody fall into, many people fall into skepticism. Like, we can't know anything.
So what happened to the work of Bertrand Russell and Alfred North Whitehead? It was just dumped?
It was just thought to be, you know, that you can, they just didn't know what to do with it. Really, people didn't know what to do with it because they'd lost contact by this time with the ground.
After Gödel, all those kinds of attempts to create the world in a sort of a mental castle are seen to be impossible.
It seemed to be impossible, but you still keep trying because it's all you got. You know, you still keep,
yeah.
But a lot of people aren't aware of the Gödel's proof and the extent of its logic, and so like I was trying to describe before, it's a hard thing to describe, but it does become sort of, you sort of become blind to your own contradiction.
Well, I mean, what impact has Gödel had in terms of the arguments you're making? Because he seems to have opened the door.
The whole idea of trying to study the world by not studying it, by putting it into a system and not studying it, is weird, right? But the problem is it works. It gets you output. It gets you stuff. And if you're not willing to take the time and study, which is really what we have to call people back to, is the time to study, to learn, to really think in principle and say, if I don't have the foundation, what the heck am I doing, and take it seriously and have the will, follow the intellect. When you do that is things like Gödel's theorem just get lost. You hear about it. This is what happened in the 80s. Hawking started saying physics is almost done. He said, we're pretty soon going to have a theory of everything. It'll prove everything. And Father Yaki came out and said, wait a second, you can't have this because you brought up Gödel's theorem. And they're like, what's this Gödel's theorem? And
So Anthony, I'm gonna sort of let us pause and sign out. And I want to promise our listeners that Anthony and I are going to have another conversation on church and culture to pick up the thread.
Sure.
But we got a minute left, and I want to repeat, you are the director of the Institute for Advanced Physics. The website is www.iapweb.org. You are in a fundraising, a matching situation until Saturday when this is first broadcast. I want to encourage our listeners to take a look. Obviously, we're talking about very important matters, fundamental matters. So, Dr. Anthony Rizzi, I really appreciate your coming on Church and Culture, and look forward to having you back very soon. Can you do that?
Yes, I can. I will do that. And I thank you very much for having me, Gil. It's been very...
Well, I got a lot of reading to do before I talk to you again.
Okay.
So, God bless, and I will be back next week on this day at this time with another wonderful guest.
If you have any comments or questions about church and culture, you can contact Deal Hudson at dhudson@avemariaradio.net.